Empire podcast this week, we're following Sandra Bullock's example and making it all about Steve with Cillian Murphy and director Tim Melons. And then we fight one battle after another with Sean Penn. All this and more on the movie podcast that just successfully didn't say it like Steve from Steve. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Honestly, that monkey. That monkey is my idol. Hello, pod. I am Helen O'Hara. Welcome to the Empire podcast. Your regular host, Chris Hewitt, is not here this week. He is away. I'm not kidding. He's playing golf on a tropical island. Rather than being here to tell all of you about all the movie news and reviews and everything else that you need, but I am here to make you a solemn commitment. I will never abandon you for golf. I may abandon you, but it will never be for golf unless there is literally nothing else in the world, okay? So that is my solemn promise to all of you. But fear not, I am not alone this week. Joining me are two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our nerd-purer.
No, oh, I like that.
Yeah, I thought you would. James Dyer.
Thank you, Helen. And especially thank you because during the pandemic, I promoted myself to Nerd Emperor. And Helen objected for reasons I don't fully understand.
Because it's higher than Geek Queen.
Yeah, right. So I'd promoted myself above Helen. Helen was having absolutely none of this. Yeah. So I went from Nerd Emperor to Great Big Fucking Nerb. Mm. And I've never managed. So thank you for temporarily putting me back on my throne.
Yeah, I do feel like we could find some other, like level for you, like patriarch, like you know what I mean, not patriarch, but what's the other one, like they used to call some religious leaders, like you could be the religious leader and I'll be the geek queen, do you know what I mean? Like that might work.
Nerd Pope doesn't really have the right
anti-pope is more you, I would say.
Archbishop of Nerd.
Archbishop of Nerdbury.
The Archbishop of Nerdbury. Do you know what? I could make that work. I'd look great in a mitre.
I believe you would. Yeah, well, you've heard her already, but we are also joined today by Beth Cassidy in the Sundance Web.
Hello.
Beth Webb, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you for humouring me and actually calling me that after I did shout that at the office at you just now. Hey, Helen, how about we call me this?
And I thought it was a good idea.
Thank you.
I just didn't have anything equivalent for James, really.
No. Yeah. How do you...
The James Whisperer?
How does one begin? Yeah.
Well, my voice is my passport, so...
That was also going to be in my intro, and then I was like, I'm just a cliche of myself making like sneakers references all week, so I'm trying to limit myself.
I see sneakers like Event Horizon is one of these films that I'm almost certain is only discussed on this podcast. Like, I don't believe it has any wider cultural footprint beyond these four walls.
It does, though. People love sneakers.
It's
it was
great.
One of the films that Edgar Wright mentioned this week in tribute to Robert Redford.
Oh, wow.
Sneakers is great. If you haven't seen Sneakers, go see Sneakers. Anyway, that's not... We're getting ahead of ourselves. Guys, geez. It is time, as you know, for a question, first of all, before we get into this week's tributes and obituaries and news and all the rest. And I have some questions. I don't know if you're going to like them, but I have them. Okay.
Oh, God.
We're going to start with this. This comes from at We Watch Films on Blue Sky. And the question is this. Thunderbirds is getting a 4K restoration double bill release over the weekend. So the question is, what children's TV show, past or present, would make an amazing premise for a live action big screen outing?
Ooh.
It's a good one.
This is a good one. Now, I posed this to Beth before and she had what I think may be the correct answer.
Yeah, and the reason pitch is Greta Gerwig's Bagpuss.
Greta Gerwig's Bad Puss. So for anyone who isn't like English and old, Bagpuss
settled down to sleep.
Oh, that was
tired,
lovely.
Just wooden bookend. What was the name of the bookend? It was the woodpecker. What was the name of the woodpecker?
I can't remember. There were mice on the organ.
Yes, Gabriel the toad.
Okay, just to set this up, Bagpuss himself is a pink stripy cat.
Yeah.
Who doesn't do very much.
Not a real cat.
No, not, well...
Like a toy cat, a stuffed cat.
He's real to me.
Described as, in the show, the most important, the most beautiful, the most magical, saggy old cloth cat in the whole wide world.
And what was his owner's name? And she loved him.
Is it Lizzie or something? God,
I don't know. And she gives him a big old hug, basically, so she has the toy cat. And then is it at night or is it just when stuff needs fixing? Like, Bagpuss comes to life and then the wooden bookend, the woodpecker, comes down and then the little mice come out of the organ and Gabriel the toad, who has a banjo, and then there's a doll and then they basically something's left in the shop, isn't it? Like a broken thing. And they all gather around it and they have discussions about what it could possibly be. And then the mice will... fix it and turn it into a thing. And they tell a whole story about it. It's the best TV show ever made. I fucking love it. I lived for Bagpuss as a child. Lived for it.
Never
there you
saw
go.
This coming.
We will fix it. We will mix it. We will make it good as new or something, whatever.
Is this why you hate animation? Because nothing could ever top Bagpuss.
Nothing tops the stop motion glory that is fucking Bagpuss.
Wow.
Yeah.
That came from the host of the Pilot TV podcast there, calling Bagpuss the greatest TV show ever made.
Not a jury in the land would convict me for that. That is 100% true.
Wow.
Yeah.
It is kind of magic. I remember there was a time, so I saw it on TV when I was very small, and then there was a time kind of pre-internet where I would say to people, hey, do you remember Bagpuss? Mm. And they would not remember Bagpuss. And I genuinely got to a point of like, I don't think I made it up. Like, I'm pretty sure it existed, but like it was, you know, there was no trace of it. There weren't Bagpuss books. Nowadays, there's like, you know, commemorative stuff in shops, but not like in the mid like 90s. There was nothing.
Snuffleupagus. Only heading can see Bagpuss.
I'd have loved a Bagpuss, like an actual, like
an
a
actual Bagpuss.
You can get them.
Gosh.
You can definitely get them.
I'm just so shocked by this like outpouring of love for the Bagpuss from James.
But it was one of these things where like, and the kind of the emotional payload for that, it's a mid-afternoon kind of like hazy round at my granddad's house kind of thing. Mm. That things like King Rollo, you know, Henry's Cat, I love all that stuff. The Flumps, the fucking Flumps.
Thank you to this question. This is absolutely magical.
But I think like if I were to pick one, I would want a Blumhouse Terrorhawks.
Oh, no, you see, you're thinking along the same lines to me because I was thinking Ari Aster's Blue Peter.
Ooh.
Right? Just like so many weird things. So Blue Peter, again, if you're not from the UK, children's TV show where people, you know, like they highlight interesting gardens that have been growing.
Vandalized by students.
Well, no, growing. Or like, you know, go and learn about the Mary Rose or raise some money for a good cause or have somebody come to the studio with an interesting animal.
Yeah.
It's a weird kind of magazine show, or was when I was little. And I don't know, I just feel like somebody could do a sort of late night with the devil kind of spin
very
on Blue
sinister.
Peter. Like the Blue Peter badges, you'd still get one, but it would be, you'd have to go through an ordeal,
Helen,
you know?
Now, don't take this the wrong way, but you 100% strike me as someone who owns a Blue Peter badge.
I know, I never considered myself worthy of a Blue Peter badge,
wow.
Also, like, I'm sorry, I would have raised money and stuff, but it was always like, oh, you've got to, you know, drop it in at your local Tesco and Sainsbury's. And we didn't have those in Northern Ireland. So
right.
I felt like I was on the back foot the whole time with Blue Peter. I felt like it wasn't for me.
That's a real shame.
That's probably shame. Why I want to turn it into a horror movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's all the traumas being exercised via that. I get what you're saying. I remember when the Blue Peter Garden was vandalised, and I think that Ari Aster would gravitate towards that particular event as a,
possibly,
you know, as an inciting incident. What else? I mean, look, there's probably a horror movie in John Craven's News Round if you want to go down that particular route.
Well, increasingly with the news today, but
well,
let's
quite,
not go there. I wonder if there's maybe something like Round the Twist.
I don't know
ripe.
What that is.
Have you ever felt like this?
When strange things happen, are you going round the twist?
What is happening?
Oh, yes, hello.
It was it Australian or New Zealand?
I think it was Australian, yeah.
Kids show from, let's say, the 90s.
Yeah.
Where strange things happened and it felt like people were going round the twist, but it turned out always to be just a strange thing, like a magic pair of trousers or, you know...
It was a
bizarre little creature.
Very surreal. I remember there was one scene where someone just gets shit on by seagulls.
Jesus.
Just like a wave of poo, which as your kid is very, very funny. God, I'm Googling this right now. It's so good. Round the Twist. I'm surprised
I think you are both slightly younger than me.
Oh, I'm 87. That's why I said Bagpuss.
Not literally 87, born in 87, I think is
no,
what we're saying.
87 years old.
Yeah. So Bagpuss, yes, but I feel like whatever this is was after my time.
It was fun. It was like a weird, surreal little Australian kids drama with supernatural elements, not in the in the shirtless case.
Do you remember Why Don't You?
What? Yes.
Yes. Why don't you? Russell T. Davis, former co-host of the Pilot TV podcast, he used to write for Why Don't You? And he went on and he's the one, like, when the storytelling, like, went absolutely wild with, like, conspiracy theories and stuff, that's because Russell had joined the writing staff and completely, like, turned the show on its head. It was quite an extraordinary time.
Okay.
Wow.
I don't remember it well enough. I remember some of the theme song, but I don't remember
Why don't you go outside and do something less boring instead?
How about Press Gang? I feel like that
Press
would be
Gang
your
with
era.
Old Dexter Fletcher.
Yeah, he could come back.
He could.
Somehow. He could direct.
He could direct.
A legacy sequel, that's what
a
you're saying.
A legacy sequel to Press Gang on the big screen. I could think it could work. I actually genuinely think there's a kind of a gap in the market for, you know, legacy sequels to weird TV shows that like only three people remember, but that could become a reference point for a new generation.
It's the way to go. Demon Headmaster was in my list as well. I can't remember if you remember that.
The book, yes, I've read the book, but I don't remember the TV series. I remember there being one, but I don't think I saw it.
It was about Demon Headmaster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember Chucky? And Chucky's Challenge and Chucky's Children. There were many Chucky. It had nothing to do with chocolate, by the way. It was like an alien thing.
Well, I'm out.
Yeah. So there was that. I remember that being slightly weirdy. There was like a flood of. Do you remember the thing they used to do? They used to do this on weekends. And this is the biggest thing that I think children nowadays just will never ever understand, which is the absolutely deranged acid trip that was Saturday morning television for kids in the 80s, whereby you'd get up. You turn on the TV, the girl, the clown on the blackboard would be sitting there with the test signal. You'd wait for TV to quote unquote start, and it would be like Gaz Top and Gilbert the Alien doing Get Fresh. And it was just a bunch of people in a field screaming and this weird entertainment show. But how they can, and it was objectively rubbish, but how they would keep you watching is they'd have some kick-ass cartoon like Centurions. You remember Centurions? No?
No, never.
They'd have a cartoon like that or Mask or something, and they'd show it in 5-minute chunks.
Oh, yeah,
spread out across this entire 4-hour show.
Yeah.
So you had to watch all the bollocks because you had to wait for the next bit of the cartoon to come on.
Yeah.
And Centurions was genuinely amazing. We were like, power extreme! And they had these big suits and like cyborg. Anyway, it was good.
Fantastic. Yeah. I'm surprised Charlie Brooker hasn't got his hands on something like that. Considering what he did to Big Brother, I feel like if he got his hands on something like this.
Gaz Top, watch out.
I think what they should also look at are the sort of the prestige 6-part pre-Christmas serials that the BBC used to do. So these would be the ones on at like 5 p.m. on the days that Blue Peter wasn't on.
Like the Wolves of Willoughby Chase.
Like the Wolves of Willoughby Chase. Now, they did try and make a film of that already and it wasn't that good. But I think they could try again. I think they could try for like Children of Green Knowe or any of the other Green Knowe books, which are about ghosts in an old house.
Nice.
It's cool.
The Box of Delights.
Box of Delights really terrify people at Christmas time. The really big untapped scene for me, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, Diana Wynne Jones. They did Howl's, they haven't done Howl's Moving Castle on TV. Obviously, they did that in the Miyazaki, but they had Archer's Goon as a TV show, and it was quite fun, but it could be better with more money and more effects.
Charmed Life.
Charmed Life. They could do the Crestomanches. They could do the Magicians of Caprona, which would be incredible. It's kind of like, what if both families in Romeo and Juliet were magicians and could do crazy shit?
Oh, sold.
Yeah, so, and also people get at one point turned into Punch and Judy characters for very little reason, but a lot of fun. It would be amazing. So I would like that kind of shit turned into the big screen outings that we all deserve.
Fantastic.
Well, we don't deserve them, but I think it'd make the world better.
Yeah.
I also think if we're talking slightly skewed Ari Aster style things, do you remember Chortle and the Wheelies? Was it Chortle or Chorten? I'm going to say Chorten. Chorten and the Wheelies. It was like a stop motion thing. There was a witch. There were lots of spiky creatures. And he was basically this random dinosaur who just wandered around the place. You are looking at me like I'm mental.
Maybe you're tripping.
Yeah, it's possible. I've just invented this entire thing.
You might
thing.
Have been just like high on sweets or something.
Do you know what? That's very likely. I had a lot of sugar in the 80s.
And still
and
today.
Still today.
I know, that has not stopped.
No, it hasn't changed.
All right, well, I think that's some kind of answer, maybe, question mark. But yeah, so we would like to see, first and foremost, Bagpuss.
Apparently so, yeah.
Everything else is negotiable, but Greta Gerwig, like, you know, quit the Narnia and work on Bagpuss.
Bring us Bagpuss.
Yeah, with James narrating, I think.
Yeah.
Exactly as he
and
just
Bagpuss
has.
Bagpuss settled down to sleep.
It's so adorable. Beautiful little cloth cat.
Okay, time for a guest, or rather two. This week, Steve.
Sorry,
it's a really serious and good film.
I know it is.
I know
it is.
We've got a little bit of Chris in all of us.
We can get through this.
We can't.
We can do this. I believe
definitely
in us.
Definitely can't.
This week's Steve. Yes. Is based on Max Porter's book Shy. It's also adapted by Max himself, but it now focuses on the headmaster character of Steve. So this is set in a sort of boys' school, an alternative education unit for people who've been excluded from other schools. It's set in the 90s. And it's basically one incredibly pressurized day for the headmaster, Steve, who's played by Cillian Murphy, who has to deal with, you know, local TV coming in to do a bunch of interviews, the boys acting up in the way that they are wont to do, pressure from the Board of Governors, and basically everything that could go wrong, going wrong. So it's a very, very difficult time. This is something that Cillian Murphy is also a producer on. He started working on it while he was making Small Things Like These with that film's director, Tim Milons. So I went along this week earlier in London to talk to both of them and find out a little bit more about how Steve came together. Enjoy. Well, Cillian and Tim, welcome to the Empire podcast. And congratulations on Steve. I just saw it last night at one of the screenings. I think you've been doing quite a few this week. Yeah. But fantastic, fantastic film. So tell me about this. It came together, I think, quite quickly while you were working on Small Things Like These.
We were still cutting it, weren't we?
I think the cutting was over, but we were still mixing, I guess, and doing the last bits. You and Max were collaborating in making, writing the movie, and you were giving notes to Max while he was writing? Or?
I think it came about from a conversation between myself and Max, who, like me and Tim, have worked together several times, and we were keen to work again. And we had such a lovely time making Small Things Like These, myself and Tim and Alan. We had such a great crew, such a great experience. We were very proud of the film. We wanted to keep that unit going if we could. And I really had an instinct that Tim would be perfect for this material. But it's such a radically different film from Small Things Like These. But I felt like, first of all, that I could go there because I could trust him, and I knew that he would push me and really, really push me in the role. So it, the script came, like Max wrote the script very quickly, and then we gave it to Tim straight up first off, and you had to think about it, didn't you?
No, I think if you talk to other directors, it's very hard to put like a movie out of your system. It takes a while. I think that's might be the reason why there are so many years between making films sometimes, but that's what's really back to back. So you kind of create a style and a universe for a certain movie, and it sticks with you for a while. So shake it out of your system is harder than you think it is. So I think with Small Things, it can't be any different, Small Things than this one. So Small Things get a little dialogue, top of the iceberg, and like Max wrote, a cathedral of an iceberg on top of the sea level. So that was like, how are we going to manage that? And I just said, get ahead, I'll skill you. Give me like 2 weeks to get my head around it, how to do this. And having a documentary background and missing making documentaries and talking to real people and doing casting projects at the same time, looking for these kids, I my way through it with my heart and soul was through interviewing these people. That's what I would do if I could one day in that school. I would go to the pain and the beauty of these people there and try to pull that out. And Max, and I talked to Max, and he said like, oh, that's easy. I can write interviews on all of them. So he wrote it all out. There's no improv. So he wrote it all out. And I used it for casting, and we saw the value there. And I think like working with these different mediums was quite interesting. And then also the love letter to the 90s. Max was always giving me playlists about the 90s. And I said like, okay, I'm hearing drum and bass, and I was watching this crazy video clips in the 90s from drum and bass and jungle, and I think that was so inspiring. And then the ideas kept floating, and then it went very fast, and I got more and more ideas, more and more ideas, and it never stopped. And I was like overexcited, but I was sincerely really anxious at the start.
That brings me to about 4 or 5 of my other questions, but I did want to ask about like the playlist. Like, were you listening to a lot of jungle on set of this one?
Not on set, but I was playing it while I was storyboarding. And I'd start drawing upside down stuff. that happened. That happened with that music. So music while you're working, I think on Small Things Like These, you're sending me playlists, and while I'm storyboarding for hours, then you just come up with ideas and you're getting into an atmosphere. So yeah. I think therefore music is so important, not only in post, but definitely in prep. It gets you in a certain mood or an unconscious flow.
And in the prep as well, I mean, you talked last night at the Q&A I was at about sort of boot camps almost for the boys. And I really wanted to ask more about that because that's fascinating to me. It's like, how did you, you know, get them into that place and sort of, I guess it was almost not just about chemistry together, but almost anti-chemistry. Like, how are they going to kind of bump up on each other, these characters?
Before you jump into that, just to say some of Tim's methodology, like Tim loves drawing diagrams and maps and for the characters. And you remember when we were doing the workshops, like he had this huge map on the wall of like, he's done them for me and all the films we've done, but of like how each boy's relationship to each other's and then also their relationship to Steve.
Amazing.
Right?
Now you're sharing my secret.
I'm writing it's all empire. This down. Yeah.
No, I think we talked it all out, like the relationship between every character. And we talked, I think we'd done that for 3 days, and we did it with you, we did it with the boys themselves, what they were thinking. And Max was there as well, so he knows the story better than everyone. But we all get a different point of view. I think an extra layer, which I think was very important, is that we talked to the boys themselves. I asked them to bring pictures with them about what is important in your life, and they talked about it, so I get to know them, and they were telling me deep secrets about their own traumas and everything, and they did it with Max as well. So I felt like the character is in transforming into the boy itself, and the other way around, and that was for me important. So there was this extreme trust. They knew exactly, so if I get in the background two boys standing there, they knew exactly what their relationship was like. They knew what to play. We made like little verbs, like one word, so they knew what they could improvise around. We did improvising sessions with everyone, against everyone, and that brings, I believe that brings the truth and the humanity into the movie.
And Killian, you were talking last night about the fact that you wanted to be very reactive in this, which was really fascinating. So how did that kind of differ from maybe other roles you've done? Was it sort of, you know, obviously you're still learning the script, you're still preparing, but you're trying to kind of almost keep it looser, I guess?
Very loose and very kind of So, you know, the my normal approach is to kind of lock myself away for months and months and months and just very privately and very quietly, kind of bit by bit, go at the character, go at the script and begin sharing bits with the director. And, you know, eventually the character emerges but that tends to be when you're playing someone that's a big distance away from you culturally or physically or whatever. And I love playing those characters, but this one, because it was written by Max for me, because, you know, I grew up in a house of teachers and all my aunties and uncles are educators and grandfathers, blah, blah, blah. So it was in my history and in my formative years, I just was surrounded by it. And also the fact that we were shooting chronologically, and also the fact that I had reached this level of kind of shorthand and trust with Tim, that on set, I really wanted it to be just no plan in how I was going to play a scene, absolutely zero plan until the scene happened. Then we'd begin to mold it together. But it was very, very scary. Because none of that sort of armor that you build up as an actor to kind of rely on, that was all gone, but also extremely exhilarating because you're just caught in this kind of eye of the storm and you're just being spun around by it. And there's nothing glamorous or kind of grandstanding or hopefully theatrical about it. It's very much like what the fuck is actually happening? How can I fix this? How would I respond to this? So it was really, I don't know if there's a term for it. How would you describe it? You know, he comes from documentary, so he's very used to just capturing these amazing moments. I remember you told me once that, like, sometimes when Lars von Trier would have his camera operator, he wouldn't really tell him the blocking, so deliberately the camera operator was, like, behind.
Yeah.
Which gives it this sort of real tension to the scene, and it felt like that a lot of the time, like, people would be up and jumping and chairs would be going and people would be responding, and it was all very loose and real. And it's quite exciting to be in that, in the middle of it.
Yeah.
But my safety net or whatever was Tim. Yeah.
And I always felt like, okay, what is this character thinking? Like, I think camera, I really sincerely believe that camera can grab your thoughts. So I felt like that's the way in all the time. This killing will, his unconsciousness or his thoughts will carry us through this movie. And then you get the dialogue there and then everything. But I still feel like his thinking and his thoughts and his feelings are actually the kind of arc through this movie all the time and in every scene.
That's like small things like these. Like barely any dialogue in that, but you always knew what was going on.
I did something new.
Yeah. Tell me about the shooting chronologically, because that sounds, I don't know how much more logistically difficult that
Pride and Glory to Kill. He came up with it. I never thought it was possible. I never dared to ask something to a producer. And you did it with Ken. And then because of shooting in one location, it was possible schedulally. I think it's, for me as a director, I see the benefit. Absolutely. I love to do it again.
Ideally every film should be shot like that, but of course in reality it's almost impossible for almost all films, just logistically and economically, but Ken Loach always insisted on it, and there's a reason his films are as good as they are, and that's not the main reason, but it's one of the reasons. And I think if you're lucky enough to have a location that allows for it, it just helps everyone, doesn't it? It helps the crew, it helps the writer, it helps the actors tremendously, and I think it certainly helps the director. Yep. So we're very lucky. Mm.
And how was it finding the location? Was that difficult? Did it take a while?
That was quite. I think at first it's always with looking for locations. You come to the right location, but you see it for the first time. You think like, that's not right. That is definitely not right. And you keep looking for a month longer and then you come back to the first location because it was always right from the start. So that's what happened with this one again.
I just wanted to ask quickly about some of the other cast. I mean, obviously Emily you worked with before, but finding Jay must have been a key piece of this and getting someone for that role.
Yeah, I think I said it before, like he said like two lines and I knew the way he sat down on the chair was looking to the camera, I knew we got him, but we kept doing sessions again and again and start. But I felt immediately very confident about he was there.
Yeah, he's just a really, really gifted actor, you know. And by coincidence or by serendipity, his dad works in alternative education. Like his dad is a headmaster of a school just like this right now in London. So it couldn't, like it was, the universe was telling us to cast him. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Meant to be. It's almost depressing how relevant this film still feels, you know, in terms of education cuts and, you know, grandstanding MPs and all the rest. But was it important that it be set in the 90s?
Well, I mean, the novel is set in the 90s, and I think Max was determined to keep it in the 90s. He's obsessed with jungle and drum and bass, you know. And I think what you just sort of highlighted why it still speaks to now, because those problems are always going to be there. They were there in the 90s. They're there now. They were there in the, you know, hundreds of years ago, but they're just exacerbated now, and or they're writ large in a way that we can't kind of ignore them. And everyone is so communicated, everybody is so hyper connected now that it's more acute. But also, the music was so good, yeah. The costumes.
I was that age.
That's
back
right.
Then I was that age of the boys, and so for me it was kind of like fairly melancholic.
Bit of time travel. So, you know, given how quickly this came together on Small Things Like These, can we expect your third film in this little series pretty soon then?
I mean, hopefully.
Fingers crossed.
Would be great.
Listen, thank you so much. Lovely to talk to you both. And congratulations on the film.
Thank you so much.
Okay, that was Cillian Murphy and Tim Milons, who were talking to me this week. All right, it is time for some movie news. Has there been any movie news this week? It has been something of a drought recently, I think I'm right in saying.
Oh, yeah. As the news editor of Empire, it's been a super chill week, guys. I've just been sat, like, asleep in my chair with my sunglasses
having
on.
The best time.
Oh, yeah. Cocktail in hand. Definitely not manic.
Okay, so what is the big news for you then this week that you've just been chilling about?
Just chilling and doing absolutely nothing about. There have been some great trailers that have come out the last few days.
Let's talk trailers. Yeah. I want to talk about Anaconda first. What in the name of holy Jennifer Lopez is going on with that?
I don't know, but I'll be honest, I'm slightly here for it. I guess it's what happens if Anaconda crashed into Tropic Thunder, and that's what I think this film has become.
Yeah, no, like the premise I am all about. I think this is a great premise. So for those who haven't seen the trailer, first of all, go watch the trailer. The premise is that Jack Black and Paul Rudd play mates, apparently normal people, not movie stars, who want to remake Anaconda, and they try and get a loan so they can go and remake the film Anaconda, and they can't get a lot of money, so they're doing it on a shoestring. And then wouldn't you know it, there they are filming in the jungle, and there's an actual gigantic snake that attacks.
I mean, it's a great premise.
It's a good premise.
Yeah.
I mean, I just worry that I really like this idea that we're acknowledging that it's a remake and that remakes are a certain kind of thing, and we're doing it anyway. But I really enjoy all of that. I'm worried that it's not very funny so far.
I mean, that's a problem. Do you know what? And obviously, I am the arbiter of all things humor. I thought it was gigglesome.
You giggled? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It made me chuckle. And I think partly because it is just deranged. And I found that with Tropic Thunder, although Tropic Thunder has a number of problems these days. But
it's commenting on those things.
It is.
Thoughtful about
and
it.
But it's genuinely very, very entertaining. And Jack Black brings that very sort of chaotic, frenetic energy.
Yes.
Which is very much in play here. And it's such a stupid idea. And they're being so stupid with it. I'm prepared to give it the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, okay. I like to think that every night Jack Black goes home and puts himself in a sort of cryogenic container and just has to power down for like 12 to 14 hours to give us that presence that he has every time that he's awake in daylight. And I mean, he has this here. I mean, Minecraft, Christ knows how he pulled that off for as long as he did. But this, it seems like he's tapping into that energy again. Paul Rudd is just being Paul Rudd at this stage. I feel like
he just plays Paul Rudd.
If you're Paul Rudd, why play anything else?
Exactly, like,
if you can be Paul Rudd, be Paul Rudd.
Yeah, of course. And Tandoe Newton, I'm really excited to see her do something silly.
Yeah.
I can't remember the last time I've seen her. Not to say that she hasn't been in silly stuff, but...
Well, she was in The Chronicles of Riddick.
Oh, good Lord. Yes. Oh, that's just thrown me completely.
Sorry.
I was like, God, that really was a film, wasn't it?
It really was a film
that happened. But very excited to see her being a silly goose.
Yes.
And I mean, if they're gonna make a film like this, if they're gonna make a remake, and I guess anything is fair game now, at least they've taken a very meta and silly and self-aware.
Sorry, anything is fair game now. I think Anaconda was 100% fair game. Yeah. Like, if you're going to remake something, I would rather have it be Anaconda than like Citizen Kane. You know, like that's okay.
Okay. I agree. Yeah.
Much as I love Owen Wilson and Jennifer Lopez and most of the rest of the cast, with one huge exception, I have no problem with them remaking it in theory. I do slightly worry that the snake looks exactly like the basilisk in Chamber of Secrets, as opposed to looking like any snake that might exist in nature on this planet.
I did take umbrage with the very small amount of
snake Dolores time. Umbridge.
Oh no.
My God. With the small amount of snake that we did see, it looked very unthreatening and... not the source of great peril.
The big one, though.
It's a big old snake.
It's a big old snake.
Massive fangs.
The special effects just made it look a little bit less.
Maybe they're trying to keep it sort of era appropriate to the original Anaconda. So they've used the same effects.
Maybe so. Well, it all remains to play for. We look forward, of course, to seeing if our Anaconda do want none. And if they have buns, son, come whenever this is out. What else we got news-wise?
Star Wars. We have a Star Wars picture, a picture of the Star Wars. So this is Star Wars Starfighter. We got a new photo. It is Ryan Gosling and Flynn Grey on set, except it doesn't look like Star Wars. In fact, it looks like Waterworld 2 because they're just...
They're on a boat.
On a boat, which is, I mean, look, I'm not one to judge, but you say Star Wars, I don't immediately think kind of maritime adventures, and yet here we are, they're on a boat in the sea.
I mean, sometimes starfighters crash, and sometimes they crash on water, not land.
Well, it would have to be a water planet, Helen, because as we know, there is only ever one biome on a Star Wars world.
Yeah,
so
this is 100%.
It's going to have to be a water world.
It is. Oh, no.
Yes, indeed. I don't know, like, so let's look at Gosling. He's looking quite tousled.
Yes, he got a nice shiner.
Yeah, little black eyes, got some leather gloves on and some, I don't know, it's a top, isn't it?
I'll say it. What I'm looking at here is a Stone Cold Scallywag.
He does have scruffy looking nerf herder energy. I will give you that.
I mean, you say that like it's a bad thing. Yeah. Historically in Star Wars, that's a really good thing.
Yeah, it turns out well.
Oh, all the best ones are scoundrels.
Yeah. They do have Star Wars energy. Like they've got stripes on their trousers a little bit. They've got holsters for, weapons that might actually, looking at it, be missing. He seems to be leaning on... Is that a tiller? I think this is an improvised raft that is mostly half-sunken ship, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
So, hopefully they figure out a way through that. He's got two gloves on. In Star Wars terms, that presumably means he has no hands.
Okay.
Am I right?
Well, gloves do tend to indicate that you've had a hand cut off.
Exactly. So that's exciting to see. Although he has hands on the poster. Look, my point is, I'm intrigued, but I don't understand what's happening, and I would like to know more.
I'm excited if it is on location. I'm excited for some on location shooting, always, over the green screens. So that could be fun.
Absolutely.
I don't know, we've not had much water-based hijinks in Star Wars, to my knowledge. I know I'm in a room with people who know a lot more than I do.
Well, of course, if you refer to the cloning planet of Geonosis, that is, of course, very, very wet, generally. And there's a great big battle in the spray, isn't there?
And there was the submarine chase in The Phantom Menace.
There's
we don't
always
talk
a bigger
about
fish.
That. Right. And then, obviously, like Obi-Wan's on the little tiny island just off the coast of Kerry. I mean, that planet.
Achto.
Achto.
Yes. Yeah. But this is like... Oh, I guess a separate.
And of course, Helen meant Luke, not Obi-Wan. Just saying.
I did.
Oh,
Star Wars faux pas.
Oh, no.
Oh, honestly, the Porg is out of the bag.
Oh, my God. Well, the Porg was actually a puffin that they couldn't paint out. Just saying.
Many, many puffins many, that many they puffins. Couldn't paint out.
So instead they leaned in. But yes, exciting that it's actually happening. It's moving forward. It's being shot.
Yeah.
Great cast.
All of which are good things.
Yes.
Can we talk about Mole Man? So
can we?
Paul Walter Hauser has been cast in Zach Cregger's Resident Evil.
Yes.
Oh, so we're not talking about Mole Man, except that he played Mole Man. Like, it's not like a Mole Man spin-off.
It's not a crossover.
Fantastic Four. Okay.
Yeah.
So he's in Zach Cregger's...
He is in Zach Cregger's Resident Evil.
This is the follow-up to Weapons, as it were, in the sense of the Zach Cregger filmography.
But not like Weapons 2.
But not like Weapons 2.
Yeah, exactly.
Although it will have weapons, because otherwise that would be bad.
Well, they'll get killed by the zombies. Yeah.
So this is an adaptation of one of the games?
Yes, Helen, that's right. You have correctly identified, he says, desperately scanning the news story to find out. Do you know what? I have absolutely no idea. I know that Zach Cregger has talked a lot about how it's going to be very different, and I think it's fairly safe to say it will not be close to the Paul W.S. Anderson Resident Evils, I would imagine, in content or tone.
Mm. So you mean the virus won't dry up the rivers?
Yeah, I mean, look, viruses do that, Helen. You just need to accept viruses do that. Yeah, look, after Weapons, and Zach Cregger can do no wrong really with me, so I'm excited to see what is done with this. And also I'm not so wedded to the IP. Oh, it's not faithful enough, or I wish they'd adapted this. I don't care, like, I don't think it matters. Like, I just think he'll do something cool, and like, if you like Resident Evil, maybe you'll find some stuff fun. But Resident Evil, and I say this with love, it's fucking nonsense. Like, the games are gibberish, they make absolutely no sense, the mythology is a jumbled mess. You go from kind of Hills Has Eyes type, like, crazy people to like, there's a, the most recent one was almost like a Universal Monsters reunion. They had giant baby demons and a 10-foot vampire. It's wild stuff. Werewolves all over the place. So, like I said, there's no consistency, because apparently the tyrant virus can do everything from turning you into a zombie to a vampire, a werewolf, make you fly, turn you into a sea monster. It's very versatile.
Drying up the rivers.
Dries up rivers. I mean, like, Yeah,
it's I'm never going to get over this.
Yeah, it's where COVID was going, essentially, is what I'm saying.
I don't know what this line is. What is the...
It is a genuine line in, I think, Resident Evil 3,
right,
where they say the virus dried up the rivers.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you're like, I don't think it can.
It's one step away from the neutrinos are mutating.
Right.
And possibly a downward step. Like, it's really bad.
Okay.
I don't love it. Anyway, hey-ho.
So many questions.
But new Resident Evil. What a time to be a gamer.
What a time.
What a time to be alive. James.
What a time. There was also the trailer for The Housemaid.
Yeah.
I've not seen this.
Well,
tell me about
this. This is Paul Feig on Simple Favor form. Mm. I think it's based on a book.
It is, I believe, yes.
It is based on a best-selling book, no less, that sold over 2 million copies. So there that is. Sydney Sweeney comes to the family home of Amanda Seyfried's character to become a housemaid, only for things to not be as they seem. But the trailer doesn't... It tells us explicitly that nothing is what it seems, but not why. And it's got a very breathy Sabrina Carpenter song over the top, just lots of melodrama. They put Sydney Sweeney in glasses to try and make her look less
sus. Oh, she's all that style.
Yeah, and a turtleneck. So she shows up all doe-eyed and preppy. But it looks like a hardcore psychological thriller, very camp and silly, and blonde women setting things on fire. And I just can't wait for this. It looks insane.
I was kind of wondering, on the basis of just purely on appearances, if there's a bit of single white female going on.
Yeah.
I think there is a little bit. Like, I genuinely had to focus a couple of times and going, right, is that Seyfried or is it Sweeney?
Mm.
You know, so I think there's going to be some interesting, like, ooh, who did what and to whom and why questions.
We're having a bit of a resurgence in these kind of films, because there's a new Ham That Rocked the Cradle that's been made as well, that's incoming. It feels like those kind of late 80s, early 90s sort of like little potboilers.
It's almost like women are on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
Almost.
Yeah.
I wonder why.
Ready to take up arms. I don't know. Could lead to something. Let's hope not.
Two women definitely on the podcast this week.
Wow.
What will happen, eh? What will happen?
Emmys are obviously this week. We'll discuss those on the Pilot TV podcast on Monday. But Andor got one.
Yeah.
One.
Which is obviously like about 17 too few, but it was for writing.
Dan Gilroy, yes, for that block, which was amazing.
Yeah, so I can't really argue with that.
Very, very excited about that. I do think it should have got more. But again, it wasn't going to, because it fundamentally didn't even get nominated in the acting categories.
Genre.
Which I think was ridiculous, but the less said about that, the better. Dominated by The Studio, The Pit, and Adolescence. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I have no complaints really about
it. Can't really argue with any of those. Yeah. We haven't seen the Pit here in this country, or at least normal people haven't, James. Maybe you have.
I have. I saw it on the plane on the way to Florida last month.
There you go.
Very exciting. It lives up to the hype. It's very, very good.
The other two are stunning. And the Studio, for anyone who hasn't seen it, I think is genuinely one of the best things about Hollywood ever made. Love it. Absolutely.
It's very, very good.
Very good indeed. Very good indeed.
If we're straddling the TV film divide, we should say The Summer I Turned Pretty, which has become something of a YA phenomenon, based on the books, and the belly love triangle. If you know, you know. I don't know what team you are, Beth, but it's continuing as a film. It's becoming a film. So it finished recently. It had its finale, and apparently the story is going to continue on the big screen.
Yeah.
Or at least on the small screen in a feature format.
I was about to say, like, they don't always release their films, do they? Yeah. Okay.
So,
I was with a friend yesterday and got to break the news to her. She's a big fan. And if anyone in North London saw a large flock of birds just take off all at once, it was because of the reaction of said friend. Like, this has an absolutely bonkers, huge fan base, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a phenomenon.
I mean, even I seem to know that there's a very small wedding ring involved, like a comically small wedding ring.
There was lots of discussion about the size of the stone, the size of the ring, whether he would have bought that ring.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was surprisingly controversial.
Yes. I think this film is going to be absolutely huge.
And this is a love triangle story, basically, that they've somehow
dragged out over
a bunch of series already. Yeah.
It's had, I want to say, I think there are there three or four books in total. I can't remember because I have not read them, because I'm not a teenage girl, despite my film taste.
It's hard to tell.
I must admit, so it's a show I don't watch. We watched the first episode on Pilot Plus because our listeners did complain that we hadn't reviewed The Summer I Turned Pretty, so we all watched it and it was good. And I did not watch any more of it. I'm so sorry. So I don't really know the latest and I don't know how the series ends, but maybe I'll catch up for the film.
Okay.
It's got some connective tissue with To All the Boys I've Loved Before. Right, I think it's either the same writer,
author.
Author, right? Yeah,
Yeah. Well, that was fun. So, okay. Well, maybe I should catch up on it sometime. Maybe I won't.
You won't.
I don't know. I'd probably not.
No. It's my foundation.
I feel there's a lot of better TV I think I need to catch up on.
Yes, agreed.
Oh, I've still got an episode of Alien Earth to go. I mean, my dance card is just full.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. Anyway, we should also talk about the biggest news of the week, very sad news that Robert Redford passed away at the age of 89. He was, of course, the actor, director, producer, founder of the Sundance Film Festival, and genuine all-round legend. Mm. Who has been on the silver screen since, 1960-odd, and been a star for most of that time. Yeah, last seen on screen at the end of the last decade in The Old Man and the Gun, and of course in a tiny, tiny role in Avengers Endgame. But yeah, this was a blow, I think. Even though he was 89 and I think not in great health just recently,
yeah,
it still felt like a real shock to everyone somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. A real loss. And it's been so lovely to see all the outpouring of tributes this week. Mm. Not to shamelessly plug, but we have a wonderful piece that Christina Newland has written for us, which is on the website. And she had the pleasure of meeting him not that long ago. And it's a really, really beautifully written, emotional tribute. So please do check that out if you want a little bit more from us on that. But yeah, what a legacy. Mm. Beyond, I'm less versed on his directing, but it's been lovely to see things like Scarlett Johansson's done a bit of press for Eleanor the Great, which is her film that she's just directed, and she said that she was inspired by him when she was on The Walls Whisperer.
That was one of her early roles, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and you know, the Sundance Institute and what he was able to do for filmmakers like Tarantino and Soderbergh got massive kind of boosts from having their work shown at Sundance.
Practically every cool filmmaker you know started off either at the Sundance Festival or in the Sundance Labs. Mm. Like Ryan Coogler and that entire generation met at the Sundance Labs and started, you know, sort of cheering each other on, you know. Yeah. Chloe Zhao and people, I think, as well. And yeah, Soderbergh, Paul W.S. Anderson, Quentin Tarantino, etc., Kevin Smith, like you name it, they started at Sundance. It's been a hugely, hugely important thing. And he wasn't like running it day to day in recent years, but he was the guy who set it up. That's why it has its name.
Yeah.
As Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
True story.
True story.
Star of Sneakers.
I mean, yeah. I mean, look, this was my introduction, I think, to... I wrote about this week, but like that was my introduction, I think, to Robert Redford. And it was because I wanted to see River Phoenix. Let's be honest. It was the 90s. Mm. But even then I was like, who's this guy? He's really cool. And obviously then went back and found Butch Cassidy and The Sting and all the rest. Interesting this week that he got very, very, you know, deeply felt tributes from Jane Fonda and Barbra Streisand, among the many, many others. But I just thought it was interesting that, like, two of the most no-nonsense, will-not-take-any-shit women in Hollywood going, this guy was one of the good ones. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something. That's a pretty good legacy to leave behind.
Yeah.
And there were also just a lot of great stories. The old chestnut about he didn't get cast in The Graduate because
he was too good looking.
Mike Nichols didn't believe he'd ever struck out with a woman. And he literally didn't understand the concept.
Sucks to be Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah, doesn't it just?
There was also a great, great quote from, I don't know who it came from, I just saw it quoted by somebody else online. Somebody asked a female film journalist around the time that Indecent Proposal came out, would you sleep with Robert Redford for $1 million? And she goes, oh, sure, but where would I get $1 million? And that's in his, 50s or 60s? So, you know. But pretty much pick a Redford film at random, almost, like, you'll have a good time. The Natural, one I didn't watch until a couple of years ago, but that's great. Mm. The Candidates, Waldo Pepper.
I have a real soft spot for Rod Lurie's The Last Castle. With James Gandolfini.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm not sure that you could class it as one of his best films, but there's just something about that film I love. I think he's fantastic.
Yeah. All the President's Men. It's a good time for All the President's Men right
it
now.
Yeah.
I swear. But that's something that he shepherded onto the screen and actually, like, was encouraging them to write the book that it was based on beforehand. Like, he was all over that. So, so yeah, it's great. It's absolutely great to look back at the films that he leaves behind, even though it's very, very sad to say goodbye to him. So that was Robert Redford, who died this week at the age of 89 years old. Okay, I think it's time for another guest. And boy, do we have a good one today. No, this is for a film that is out next week. This is One Battle After Another, which is the new film from Paul Thomas Anderson. This is the story of, gosh, it's quite sweeping. It's the story of a kind of band of revolutionaries led by Teyana Taylor and her slightly more hapless right-hand man, Leonardo, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, and how they cross paths with a tough military type called Lockjaw, played by Sean Penn, and true to his name, he grabs on and won't let go of them and becomes kind of obsessed with bringing them down. It's a bit of a return to the screen for him. He feels like he hasn't been around much in the last few years, but he is, of course, the guy who broke through in the 80s, who was kind of an enfant terrible, if you will, of the early 80s, matured into one of the best actors in the world in the 90s, and yet, turns out still really good. So yeah, we sent along Alex Godfrey just to talk to him this week in London. Just a word on this. This kind of starts mid-interview because they were just chatting and then the tape went on and they just kept chatting. So don't worry, you haven't missed anything, but please enjoy Alex talking to Sean Penn.
How are you doing? How was last night? There was a screening and a Q&A, I think, Leicester Square.
I think it was a good Q&A. We were only there for the Q&A. We weren't at the screening. We came late afterwards.
Do you watch your films again?
I went to this, the Los Angeles premiere.
Yeah.
Saw it there. And I think I'm going to sit through it tonight because I've got some friends that are coming and I haven't watched it.
Yeah.
This is a pretty watchable film. I could watch, notwithstanding me, I could certainly watch all the other actors many times over.
When it gets to this point, can you watch it and detach from the fact that you're watching yourself? Can you see the overall?
I think I always detach from the fact that I'm watching myself.
Really? Because there's so many actors who just cannot even watch the films once when they're done.
Yeah, I don't pay a lot of attention to me when I'm watching the film. I already know what's there. And so I can kind of, that's interesting how this theater has this thing. But not because I'm not taking anything away or giving anything myself. Just,
yeah.
I think once I've done it, I'm detached.
Yeah.
It just happens. But this movie, I'm not detached from at all. I'll watch this movie over the years, I think, a lot because the movie is so. I'll say it this way. Paul Thomas Anderson is freaking touched. He's got original, but original not in the sense that it separates itself from others. This movie becomes interactive with the audience. The audience makes a great film even greater when watching it. And that was what was exciting about it. And it was also a real tribute to that ancient thing we call the movie theater. This is really a movie that should be, an effort should be made to see in the theater, not only because of the image and the vista vision of some of the theaters, but because there's a, I think the audience gets a bond watching it, and they don't miss anything from, it doesn't matter the gender or the color or the age. My experience watching it at that premiere was that everybody in the room understood every nuance. So it's a very shareable experience, even if original.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because there's so much going on in it. It's an action film and a family drama and a political drama slash thriller. And there's a lot that it's tackling politically, but it's completely accessible. It's mainstream. You know, you don't get lost. I mean, it's 2 hours. It's over 2 hours and 40 minutes, but it's so propulsive. And he's taking on so much with it in terms of what he's exploring and the characters he's doing that with. But you never feel like he's on a soapbox or hitting you over the head with it. That's the, for what, you know, considering all that's involved with it, there's a lightness of touch, which I think is extraordinary.
Yeah, I would well described.
You were talking just earlier about, you know, his talent, and he's always, you know, right from the off, he's been incredible. I did read the other day that it was too late by the time you wanted to do it, but you had an inclination to play Adam Sandler's character in Punch Drunk Love. Is that?
Well, it wasn't so much that it was too late. I wasn't his choice for that role. he asked me to play another role after he had already cast Adam. But I, once I read the script, I thought, you know, I really this was something I wanted to do. And I said, let's wait till the next time. So
it's, I mean, I love that. We'll get on to Lockjaw again and One Battle in a minute, but it, I love that you were attracted to that role, because I love that film and I love what Sandler did with it.
I did too.
So you read it obviously before it was shot. Mm-hmm. Considering that you thought, oh, I'd love to do that myself, and considering that you were obviously attracted to what that character was, what was it then like seeing another actor interpret that in ways that I imagine were different to what you might have had in mind?
I detached and I just saw Adam Sandler's version. He's great. And it was a total surprise, because this is a case in point. That was his interpretation of it, and it was great.
Yeah.
It had nothing to do with my interpretation of it.
Do you know what? So this might be a cheesy thing to say, but I was, because I read that you were, I read that about you, and I was thinking about this film. Obviously, the character in Punch Drunk Love is, doesn't have much in common with Lockjaw, but they're both really angry men, tightly coiled with very short fuses, and they're both sort of constantly on the verge of boiling over with rage, which I thought was interesting. I mean, you don't, they're not, you know, obvious bedfellows, but there's something about these men who can't control themselves that Paul writes really well. I wondered what your take on that might be.
Well, answering the question invites me to do what I consider a spoiler, which I don't want to do.
Okay.
I'm kind of religiously don't want to talk about what I think of, you know, confirming or denying your description of the character may well be the case, but there's a big difference between you objectively observing something and sharing it with your audience.
Yeah.
And when from the source it gets, then they have less of the experience that I had when I read the script the first time. I just want it, I want this whole film to be originally interpreted. I had such a great time reading the script and being surprised on every level, where no actor had gotten in my way by telling me, you know, what they think of their character in this way or that. I don't want to be bothered with that. I want to just see it.
Yeah. Had you stayed in touch with Paul over the years?
Yeah.
Had he spoken about this film? I know you were in Licorice Pizza, but he said he's been working on this for a couple of decades or so. Had he spoken to you about it?
I think he had, you know, Adam Sumner in particular, a couple of what I would call his skiff mates, those in a close hold department. I wasn't that close with him, you know, in a consistent way. But otherwise, he holds things pretty close. And so, no, I had no idea what I was reading until I got it.
I think he said, I mean, I assume you would know this, correct me if I'm wrong, that he wrote this part for you.
I'm not sure of that, but I think he has said things that indicate that, and I've never investigated it.
Okay. I mean, but having maybe heard that, could you see, do you know what it might have been about you that he thought would work?
What I know is that when I read the script, I was laughing a lot, and I pretty quickly heard what I thought was the music he was writing, and by that I mean who this character was and how, and kind of I could feel things happening in my body that were going to go there. And that was making me giggle a little bit. And it was written so well that there wasn't a lot of second guessing.
Yeah.
You know, you just kind of say, well, this is the private letter he's writing to me within this script. Yeah. So I'm going to listen to it, lock out everything else, and go.
I should say just for our listeners, let me briefly sum up Lockjaw, but Colonel Stephen Lockjaw. I mean, I've talked about his personality a little bit, but he's after Leonardo DiCaprio's character, Bob, who's a fugitive in hiding because of the freedom fighting from his younger years. And Lockjaw is, let's just say, in pursuit. There's something Terminator-esque about him. He won't stop. What I love about him is that he has no redeeming features. Unless people would disagree with that, I can't really see any. He's very human in ways that you give him all of these dimensions. He's got this very physical manifestation of insecurity. It's almost like he's a little boy trying to project this air of power, and it doesn't quite, it's not really becoming of him. But Leonardo DiCaprio was saying that you added stuff to it that wasn't on the page, certainly in terms of this sort of insecurity and some of the physical things you did with it. Can we talk about that at all in terms of what you wanted to bring to him physically? Because he's got this, you're just watching him on screen all the time, and the guy can, he doesn't really know how to express himself.
Well, I mean, I suppose just in a general way that you could say that with material like this, so by way of example, if someone writes down morality,
yeah,
what does that mean to the person who's reading it? Well, if you erase that word in context of everything and you put lethality,
yeah,
then how does that affect things? And which one is more sacred?
Yeah.
To who? Right? So this is a script. The writing of it is provocative that way. And you can play with your brain with great writing. You can kind of replace little things that make big changes that you don't have to think about.
It's true. And what you do with him in the film, and what Paul is doing on a whole, on one level, in terms of what it's exploring, in terms of the more nefarious characters in the film, it seems heightened, and there's a sort of absurdity to it, and it's played for, you know, entertainment to some extent. But really, it's not actually that heightened. It's not.
Well, the more nefarious characters in our world have, even in the time since we've shot it, you know, subtracted some of the kind of high concept farce that might have been attached to it, because now we're following the lead of the real world.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, it's interesting seeing how the audience reacts to the film, because some of the scenes involving your character and some other characters he comes into contact with are funny, but also chilling at the same time, because, you know, you have this awareness that it's not untrue. And there are people who behave like this, mm-hmm. and think like that. I'm assuming that's one of the things that excited you about doing it.
Yeah, I remember I don't know what page I was on, short of 20, when I said, wow, he's going there.
Yeah. Because yeah. Not many directors do this, and certainly not in the way that he does it.
Yeah, no, this thing's been a gift for, I think, all the actors on this field this way. For all of us, because to have something, this experience reminds me more of my best experiences in the theater than in the movies.
In what way?
Well, the absolute interdependence of an ensemble cast, the excellence wall to wall of this cast. I remember showing up on set, well, from my first scene, the movie was with Teyana Taylor, and it was so immediately clear, because they'd been shooting and I hadn't yet, what the bar of this playing field was, you know, that these people had what Marlon Brando used to call suiting up, uh-huh. like having to really suit up for this one. Everybody was extremely focused, and it was kind of game on and great. And then also, you know, the big difference in film from theater, I think, is that the director in theater is typically weaning you off dependence on the director. Where in film, at its best, I think it's constantly subtly directed, that there's a guidance system, that after a take in the process, you can look at your director and with a look, he can tell you more or less left, right, you know, red, yellow, that whatever it is to make an adjustment. The problem is there are very few directors who can offer that productively. And so it becomes all a hybrid where you're taking off of this colleague as an actor. That might be your go-to first look to check in. How did that seem to work? Is there anything more I can do for you in the scene? Is there anything? And in this one, we all knew one clear source we're going to look to, because the trust in Paul that we as actors feel is complete. And he's a great director. He's a great writer director.
Have you felt this with maybe just a handful of directors?
A handful of directors, but in very few cases, would they also be the writer in full?
Oliver Stone, maybe?
Well, Oliver is a very complete director. You're not going to win any battles or wars by beating him in a battle. We battled a fair amount. He was still going to figure out how to do it his way. And I like him a lot. He's, you know, been extremely wrong on things like Russia. He's an addicted iconoclast. But I like his boldness and I like him. And I think he's done some great things in film. And I'm still a fan. But that's not this. And it's, I don't know how much Oliver trusts actors and vice versa. This is the best of what comes with, I think, a very healthily confident, clear-minded artist.
It's interesting that you were talking about parallels with theater. I was talking to Paul a few hours ago and I was asking him about the supermarket scene, going in there with a couple of cameras and just going for it. And I was saying how interesting it is for a film with a scale like this, with a budget like this, with actors of this level, still being able to go into a place like that and do that and just roll the punches. And he was very, he didn't seem to think it was a big deal. He's like, why bother if you can't still do that? But there are, many films on this level where that wouldn't happen, or the directors maybe wouldn't do that.
Well, he brings such a kind of calm to things. And because also what you're leaving out is that to do that with Leonardo DiCaprio in the scene and shoppers coming in to go to the market in their local community, I think it's sort of like, look, if you and I go to lunch and there's a painting on the wall at the restaurant that's interesting and we walk out and you say, "Guy, I'd really like that painting." There's some people sitting at the table now, but if we go in there like we were hired by the restaurant, I'm sure the manager wouldn't know that the owner didn't call us. Let's just go in there and say, "We're supposed to pick this up, take it off the wall and go." I think Paul knows how to do that.
Yeah, a heist. Well, it must be exciting for you to be in that sort of situation on a film like this where it does feel alive and there is an edge of edginess and unpredictability to it. And you've got real people around you. Because I imagine a lot of bigger productions, you don't get the opportunities to feel that so much.
Mm-hmm. No, this isn't unique. This is why I say it's like a gift, It was a great experience. And I think that, and it's not just the actors who had that. It was true top to bottom of the crew.
But when I watched the performance from you, it looks like you're having the time of your life just getting to play this character. Obviously, he is reprehensible, I think it's fair to say.
I'm not going to affirm that it's obvious, but
no, okay. Okay. Well, I wouldn't want to meet the guy. But it's really entertaining performance because of what you do with it and what you do physically with it. And, there's a lot of value in just watching that guy. Did you, I don't know if it's the right word to use, but did you enjoy playing him? Because it looks like fun.
I had a great time making this movie. And I think mostly because of the, we take, of course, at the highest levels, we are highly rewarded, let's say, well paid. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean there's not an enormous amount of commitment to focusing on one thing for a period of months. And it's its own sacrifice and after many years of doing film, when you're going back to a hotel, they booked you at night on some location, you're looking in the ceiling, it's really easy to say, "What the hell am I doing here with my life? Mm-hmm. I'm not getting any of this time back." And when you're surrounded by highly competent people or more than that, artists, and an entire crew of such commitment, which has all been orchestrated by the guy you're looking at after the take, mm-hmm. handpicked a family to make this thing, to have that kind of trust that this is worth it, you're never looking at the ceiling thinking that. You're thinking, I can't wait to get back tomorrow.
Which is not an experience you would have had every time, I'm sure.
No. You know, I mean, you look at the guys who are special operators. They come back and somebody doesn't know how to use the cash register. They've just been working with guys who excel at the highest level of everything they do. And it's frustrating. And so when you get kind of invited into something like this, just to, you know, there is a level of enjoyment.
Yeah. Well, it comes through. All right. Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. That was Sean Penn talking to Alex Godfrey. And it is now time for our reviews section. So where shall we start? Shall we start with, I'm really trying to say it right. I swear I am. Steve. No. Steve. The sensible, mature drama. Steve. Oh, no. Beth, tell us more.
Okay. No, yes. This, you said it beautifully in the introduction and with the interview. So, yes, this is based on Max Porter's short story, I believe, which was told from the perspective of Shy, this boy who was part of a specialist school in the 90s. And for the film, they've spun it so that it's about the head teacher, played by Cillian Murphy, who we just join him in a chaotic spell. So a couple of days at this place, but then you quickly learn that this is actually just life at this this particular school. It's all young men who have all manner of difficulties. They've had troubled upbringings. They have certain disorders, a lot of violence, a lot of, you know, unnavigated feelings, which, you know, in the 90s as well, we did not have the dialogue that we have now to kind of assign meaning to things quite as they did then. But it's very much about the staff and students of this school, and the kind of thrust of the story comes because his TV crew comes to film them over the course of a day. And there's also an MP that comes and visits them in what's a very sort of showy act for the cameras as well. And so Cillian Murphy, Steve, great. Growth. There's a bit of past there that we find out later into the film, but he is harboring a lot of difficult feelings, also addicted to drugs. I can't remember if it's opioids or...
I believe it's OxyContin, isn't it? Something similar to that.
Yeah, something in that field, I would say. Very reliant on pills and very harried. But my God, does he have a beautiful way with these young men, which is really just very, very special to watch. This is produced by Cillian Murphy as well, as you mentioned. And he really is the beating heart of this. He had a very hard time making this film. We did a character deep dive with him in a past issue of the magazine. And it really did put him through the ringer mentally because of the sheer weight of responsibility that this man goes through. They've got all these external pressures, financial issues, a lot of red tape. People really do just write off these boys at face value. And, you know, they are troubled. They are violent. You see fights and chairs being thrown and all sorts of abuse happening between them and occasionally towards the staff as well. But then the job writing, and I think this is because Max Porter did adapt from his own book, there's a lot of nuance and joy and heart also shown when depicting these characters as well. And it's all carried by the most wonderful performances by these young actors. It is a real feat in casting. Most of them are known. I couldn't really pick sort of stronger performers over each. They all bring their own kind of special sauce to this ensemble. I would say the guy who plays Shy,
Jay Lycurgo.
Thank you. Has a little bit more to do in terms of story. And is a bit more still waters run deep with him. We join him as he's got some terrible news in terms of his family, and we see the aftermath of that and how he just fails to cope with what he's been told. And the sophistication of that performance from that young performer is just brilliant. So there's a lot of great, great acting there, all shepherded by Cillian Murphy, who was just, I mean, he's come from these big, prestigious, you know, major studio films, but to see him channeling something more pained and sorrowful, but, you know, dutiful as well, like, is just wonderful. Just really, really wonderful to see. It's beautifully written, very robust character study of everyone involved in. I think it's excellent. I think it's essential British storytelling, British filmmaking.
Because Max Porter, obviously, he's adapted this from his novella, but the novella, which I think you mentioned, is called Shy, and it's very much from the, I want to say, the boy's point of view.
Yeah.
And this is very much a Steve-centric thing, with him juggling everything from, like, the sale of the school to the boys and whatnot. It's interesting. So we gave this 4 stars.
Yeah.
Spoiler for the end of the review.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I was somewhere between the 3 and the 4 camp.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, I thought it was a great performance, but I just... And I think the way he interacts with the boys, as you said, is wonderful. And there's a bit where he talks about the kind of the personalities and the backgrounds and the inner life of each of these boys at one point. And I thought that was a really great scene because it makes you look at these boys in a way that I think people don't and wouldn't do, because it's very easy to sort of write them off as just troublemakers, violent, you know, nightmare teens. And how he sees them, what he sees in them, I thought was just lovely. Mm. The sort of humanity of that I thought was great. J. Lai Kogo, who's really good in Joe Barton's The Bastard Son, The Devil Himself, which shockingly got cancelled but is available on Netflix. He's really, really good in this. That said, I think his arc for me was the bit that didn't quite ring as true. Like, it felt a little bit screenplay-y, if that makes sense. Yeah, I
disagree.
Whereas I preferred the slightly more kind of low stakes but real organic, you know, troubled teen stuff really worked for me. That it felt a little bit like, okay, we need a central bit that needs to have a little bit more drama in it, and that didn't quite ring true for me. Also, I think the extent to which Steve is dealing with his own shit, I didn't think that was, on the one hand, explored deeply enough for me. And also, I felt like his addiction to a variety of drugs and alcohol, it just felt a little bit like, all right, we're laying this stuff on a little bit thick. I wonder whether a little bit more subtlety would have gone a longer way there. But like I say, I loved it. The kind of the faux documentarian style really kind of embeds you in it. Mm. And the fact that he's arguing with the camera crews at time, I think is a nice touch. And it definitely has an authenticity to it. And it is a great performance. So yeah, I thought it was great. But the one thing I would say with this is before we recommend it to people is there is a genre of filmmaking that I would put Boiling Point and Uncut Gems in, which is the anxiety attack as celluloid genre. And this very much falls into that category. Not all the way through, but for, I would say, most of the runtime, you are just like, oh my fucking God. Like, it's so stressful. And I did a double bill of this and The Lost Bus back to back. And let me tell you, I don't recommend it. So
why your blood pressure is so high.
So be aware, if you have any kind of heart condition, you might want to pace that shit out and maybe put a big, bold, beautiful journey in between the two.
That does make sense.
Throwing that out there.
I also loved it. I would put it very... I didn't find it as stressful as Uncut Gems and Boiling Point. I will say it's on the it is on that spectrum, but it's lower down than those two.
Sure.
And I do think there is an argument that, yes, so many awful things happening in one day is maybe piling on a little bit more than it needs to be. But these are minor nitpicks because I thought it was just such a fascinating film. And as the daughter of a teacher and a social worker, I feel very much like this is the kind of stuff that we need to talk about more, that these are not bad people. These are just people who need to, you know, figure out how to channel anger and figure out how to cope with a world that has not necessarily given them everything that, for example, people like us have been given in this world. So I just feel like that it's a really compassionate film in that sense. And the compassion really comes through. And I think a lot of the sort of small p politics of it are about that cry for empathy that is lacking a lot this at the moment in the world. So I feel like that really, really rings true, and that really came through for me. And that does come through in the Shy character in J. Lai Kogo's performance as well, who is fantastic in this. Mm-hmm. But yes, all the boys were. And if you listened to the interview and didn't skip it, you will have heard Tim Milons, who does a very good job in this, talk a little bit about how they managed that and how they sort of created the relationships between everyone so that the sort of, the, you know, whatever's happening in the background makes sense for those people and makes sense for those characters at all times. And we should say for Tim as well, I mean, this is the second film they've made together, or the second feature film they've made together after Small Things Like These. And that was such an internal, quiet, restrained, subdued film. And this is kind of the opposite of that. Like, God bless Steve. I think he would love to sit in the quiet for like 30 seconds and try and figure stuff out. In this case, no one gives him that moment. Like, everybody is shouting at him at all times. There is some kind of fire that needs to be put out. And it's such a different energy. It's really, really fascinating. So I'm excited to see if they do another one next. I would really like to see, maybe they can just balance the levels of stress next time. I don't know. But yes, this was 4 stars then for Steve, which is a big recommendation from us. Let's do exactly as James suggested and sandwich a big, bold, beautiful journey in the middle here. Tell us about the new Coconada.
This is from Coconada, who brought us Columbus and After Yang. But this is a very different beast. And I think part of the reason for that is he didn't write this one. So this comes from Seth Rees. He's penned this. And it was on the blacklist, I think, for a few years before it got made. And it is a whimsical, kind of magical, surrealist fable in the kind of same breath as, I mean, to be honest, partly The Life of Chuck, partly Big Fish. I mean, I think they'd like it to be Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, but it's in that kind of milieu, if you will. Like, it's slightly fantastical. It's a little bit twee. But anyway, I'll tell you the story of it because, you know, that's a useful piece of information. So Margot Robbie plays Sarah and Colin Farrell plays David, and they meet at a wedding of a mutual friend. And God, how to even get this into words? So they both hire cars from a slightly weird and surreal car rental agency run by Phoebe Waller-Bridge with an inexplicable German accent and Kevin Klein as a mechanic. And the sat-nav, which looks like Hal from 2001, is sentient and asks them if they want to go on a big, bold, beautiful journey, and essentially spends the next hour and a half shipping them together. And what this sat-nav does is, on the way back from said wedding, after a product placement ad for Burger King, takes them to a series of stops where there are mystical doorways floating in the middle of the field or wherever it is that they completely take in their stride and don't bat an eyelid at. And they go through the doors and it enables them to essentially re-experience and relive pivotal emotional milestones from their past. And they share thoughts about it because they both experience each other's past in this. And bit by bit, they peel back the layers of who they are and essentially, spoiler, fall in love. So that's broadly speaking what. So it is, you know, it's a romance story. It has a lot of heart to it. And this is right up my alley. Like, I love a whimsical love story. You know, I'm really into this kind of stuff. But I have a few quibbles. And I think Coconada, what he's done with this is, like, you take something magical like this, you take something whimsical like this, and I feel like it needs the visual invention of an Eternal Sunshine or a Big Fish. And this is almost underplayed visually. It's almost dogme at times. Like, it's really minimalist. Not always. Like, there's a theatrical scene which actually is works very well. But there's a bit here where I'm like, if you're going to have larger-than-life emotions and reality, I think you need the aesthetic to go with it. And I think it kind of, the restraint here, I don't think served the film particularly well. I do think that like, Margot Robbie and Colin Farrell are both very good in this. I think she in particular, you know, does loads with a part that, I'll be honest, has more than a hint of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl about it. Like, and I didn't need to wait until the end credits to know this was written by a man. Let's put it that way. I think she has male fantasy written all over her. And I think while it would be unfair to say these characters have no inner life, and also untrue because this whole film was about unpacking their inner life. And I think, you know, it peels back layers of trauma to explain why he is commitment phobic, while she is quite spiky and impenetrable and sort of elusive and slightly aggressive at times, but then withdrawn at others. You know, and you see that the traumas that form that, it all feels a little bit basic. Like, yeah, I found that their psychology, I was like, I see what you're doing here. You're getting under the skin of these characters, but there's not much under that skin. And I felt they were a little bit too thinly drawn, which is a real shame, because if the whole film is about delving into their psyches, you need something to be there. And ultimately, I think the other part of this is that it's these two characters getting to know each other and really see each other, and to be the person that has seen the other person for the first time. And the dialogue is quite leaden at times and very on the nose. And, you know, I think the best films like this have incredibly organic, sparky dialogue that feels like, I mean, not always how real human beings talk, but at least how you want real human beings to talk. And this, the dialogue to me was just quite functional at times.
I think it's not even that. I think he does, and he did this in After Yang as well. there's almost a Yorgos Lanthimos style. Real people have never spoken like this, but this is what I want you to do. Thing going on. Like, it's certainly in some of those early scenes at the wedding, the way Colin Farrell in particular talks, and to a lesser degree, but still present degree, the way Margot Robbie talks, that is like After Young, and that is also like, you know, The Lobster or something like that. Yeah. Like, it has that real sort of almost conscious artificiality to it. And I think that that is a problem, like, for the same reason, I think. It takes you out of reality even before you've been taken out of reality by any of the other stuff going on. Like, when he first goes into the very, very weird car rental place, he's already not reacting like a real
human. Like a normal human being would, yes.
So, well, you're already slightly sideways from reality, and that's before anything gets going. And it kind of... that's frustrating, because I think it does mean that it's a harder sell, it's a harder buy than to kind of buy into this essentially, you know, film storytelling as therapy advert.
Yeah.
Because that is basically what they're doing here. They're like, well, you'll only ever have a healthy relationship once you've gone to therapy, so let's just send these two to therapy and then hope that that works out for them. Yeah, and I'm like you. I love this kind of shit. I'm the person who loved The Adjustment Bureau. Nobody loves The Adjustment Bureau.
I will go on record right here, right? And I think I've said it on this podcast. The Adjustment Bureau is the most romantic movie ever made, and I will die on this fucking hill.
It's really good. I like it, but this is no Adjustment Bureau, sir. Like, it
no, it's
wants
not.
To be. It's aggressively whimsical.
Yes.
I would slightly disagree on the style of it. I do think it's got some style. Like, they're always color-coded, the way they're dressed, yeah, you know, like that kind of thing.
The palette is lovely.
The palette is lovely.
But it is still quite restrained. And there's that weird, and they use a museum motif, but it does mean sometimes you've got these characters talking about larger-than-life things while wearing very neutral palettes in a completely...
Black
room, like without any kind of...
Yeah, that was odd.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very odd at times, but I don't think always successfully. So I wanted to be...
Same.
To buy into this 100%, and I actually bought into it maybe 47%.
Well, I'm with you, and I think it had the potential to be exactly what I wanted it to be, but I think it just needed a script that fired on all cylinders. I think it just needed punching up a little bit, which was a real shame.
And maybe even the script could have worked if you leaned into the reality at the beginning and then
took it
further from reality later on. As it is, it's all very much of a piece.
It doesn't swing for the fences, I think, is part of it. Like, I think it just needed to have a little bit. It needed to be a bit bolder, a little bigger, and a little bit more beautiful, and then
true.
I'd have been happy with it. I actually, despite having said all that, had a pretty good time watching this. I enjoyed it. And yet when I came out and saw that we'd given it 2 stars, I was not in any way shocked and fully predicted that is what it would get.
Yeah.
For me, it's a 3 because I'm predisposed towards it, but it's also a 2.
I just feel like we need Colin Farrell to be making more rom-coms, not fewer.
Yeah.
And this feels like, therefore, like a wasted opportunity. So 2 stars from me as well for a big, bold, beautiful journey. But all is not lost, but the bus is lost. Because we have one more review. Tell us about The Lost Bus, James.
Yes, this is Paul Greengrass's latest movie, and this is co-written between him and Brad Inglesby, who wrote Mare of Easttown, and of course Task, which is currently showing on HBO with Mark Ruffalo, which is very, very good, and you should watch it if you're not already.
It's really good. It's really good.
Pilot
Forever.
Exactly.
No, Pilot
Forever.
Oh, no.
That's it. There are two of us on here.
Darren, cut all of them out. Just everything they've said so far.
This is kind of based on the 2021 non-fiction book Paradise, One Town Struggled to Survive an American Wildfire, which is a very on-the-nose title. You can see why they changed it. That said, I don't think The Lost Bus is a great title for a film, but it is a well-told and well-rendered kind of survival slash disaster movie. So this is about the 2018 campfire in Butte County in Northern California, which was apparently the deadliest, most destructive wildfire in California history, which is saying a lot, especially recently.
Well, at that time anyway, it was.
Yeah, I don't know if it still is, but it's still listed as that, so let's assume it still has
that title.
I think
it's still deadliest, but maybe not the most destructive.
Right. And there is, you know, and there's a line in here which very, very clearly points to the climate change origins of this stuff. I'm not sure it's the most subtly delivered line, but I think it lands. But anyway, this is Matthew McConaughey stars in this, and he is Kevin McKay, and he is a bus driver, and he's returned to this area, this kind of area called Paradise, where he grew up, but he's since moved away, and he's come back with his son. His father's recently died. He's looking after his mother. He is sort of a newly minted school bus driver. He's not having the best time. His relationship with his son is rather strained. His relationship with his ex-wife is rather strained. He is, I think it's fairly safe to say, a bit of a fuck-up, and he hasn't really got a handle on his own life. He's struggling, frankly, to pick up and drop off kids on time, which is the whole of his job. But when this fire starts, which is due to a kind of poorly maintained power line, which ignites this wildfire, which kind of consumes the entire county and gradually becomes more and more serious. And it gets to the point where they're firefighting and then they're evacuating and then they're just, oh, we are just incredibly screwed at this point. But he, because he's in the wrong place at the wrong time, he's running late on his bus run, he is asked to take a bunch of kids, there's about 23 kids, and he picks them up from one school and he's asked to evacuate them to another school where their parents will pick them up. Obviously, the fire has other plans and it all goes downhill from there. So you have him, and then you have America Ferrera, who plays Mary Ludwig, and she's a school teacher looking after the kids. It's basically those two and a bus full of kids and a lot of flames, and that's this film. Now, Paul Greengrass is exceptionally good at that high stress, in your face, shaky camera filmmaking that makes you feel like you are in the midst of it and having a nervous breakdown. And this film is about 2 hours and 10 minutes of crying children and smoke and stress. It's really, really effective in the way the best disaster movies are, where you are never able to relax. You are always tense, and it is so gripping, and you are so, you become incredibly invested in what he's like. He's pouring over this map. Well, if you go this way, when, oh, this bus isn't really designed to get around, oh, we're going to have to take this road. And you go, no, no, take the other road, take the other road. Like, you get really, really into it. And, you know, obviously we don't want to spoil what happens, but suffice it to say, the fire makes everything a lot more difficult. And the sheer kind of primal, atavistic terror of what that must be like when the whole world around you is burning, there's smoke everywhere, like day becomes night, and there is nowhere safe to go. It's incredibly stressful, and I think Greengrass does an incredible job of doing it. So I think it's really well executed. I think we gave this 3, which I thought was harsh.
Well, here's why.
And I think now that I've said it, Helen O'Hara might have given it 3, so this should be fun.
I gave it 3 for two reasons, principally two reasons. First of all, I don't know that we needed to spend that long on all of McConaughey's character's life before the fire. I understand we need a bit of context, but I felt like I was being beaten over the head with, this guy is a fuck up and he's bad at his job. I mean, it's 45 minutes of the film just telling us that this guy is a fuck up and he's bad at his job. He's the anti-Steve. Mm. He is. And look at us both saying Steve like
Steve.
James. But he really is. And I think I was just like, I get it. Okay, move on. And I understand that you don't necessarily want to soft soap it and brush over that, because that would be the kind of Hollywood way of doing it. And, you know, Paul Greengrass is much more invested in reality and nuance than that. I do get what he's, I think, going for there, and what he and Brad Inglesby are going for there. But I also just felt beaten over the head with it. And like, this is all a distraction. Get on with it. So that was a problem. And then I also thought that the, you know, we cut back to the fire chiefs and the effort to contain the fire, or at least figure out a way to evacuate the town and get people to safety and everything else. We keep cutting back there, and I just wanted more from that than I got. I felt like that was very exposition central.
It's quite palate cleansy. They're like, we've got tension. Oh, we're going to break away here, and then a couple of minutes, and then we'll break back.
But it's always like it's palate cleansing in the sense that then they say, but I hope nobody goes left off this road.
Cut back to Matthew McConaughey going, yeah, we're going to go left down this road.
It's that kind of thing, you know. And look, again, you've got a disaster story to tell. Yeah. Like, you have to do a certain amount of exposition. You have to get that in somehow. We have to know that as an audience, even if they don't know it on the bus. But I feel like every time they did, it just felt like we lost momentum, and we just were kind of bogged down in not very good dialogue, if I'm honest. I'm sorry.
I would definitely give you that.
And I think there is a way, and we've seen it in other Paul Greengrass films apart from anything else, there is a way to make those characters pop and sing and be just as interesting and fascinating as the people on the bus. And I didn't think this film did that. I think this film just had them be cardboard cutouts, you know, hero types doing their best. And I felt like I wanted to see more of the panic and the stress and the tension of the moment from them, even in just little tiny moments. I'm not saying I needed anyone who didn't have a nervous breakdown to have a nervous breakdown. I just needed to see them like take a breath and then go, right, let's do this. You know, and I just didn't feel like I was getting character work from them. I felt like I was only getting exposition.
Other than the 45 minutes of exposition.
Well, the 45 minutes of character work. Exactly. Yeah. But I just felt the character work could have been more evenly spread across the cast.
You know,
is maybe what I'm saying.
I quite liked the character work at the front. I think partly because you understand that he's had this big fight with his son. He's struggling with it. And he has to make this difficult decision when he picks up the kids, which is, do I go home, because his son is at home, to check on his own son, who's like a teenager, he's like 15, although he's not quite sure how old his son is, or do I go and pick up these kids? And he makes a decision to pick up these kids. But all the way through, the drama is not just how do I keep these kids alive. He is so terrified because he has no idea what is happening to his actual son, and he just wants to get back to his son. So he's like, I need to get these kids somewhere so I can literally go home. And I kind of, that really added to the stress for me. And America Ferrera has a similar situation. You don't really understand a lot about that because her characterization is pared back. But I thought it added an extra layer of anxiety to an already quite anxious film.
Yeah, but maybe it was deliberate, but it threw me off because they spent so much time establishing that he wants to get home to his son that I was like, is he going to drive this bus up to his house?
I thought he would.
Looking for them? I thought that's how it feels, because why else am I hearing this much this early on about the son nonstop?
Yeah, we get the blow by blow of exactly what his son's fever is looking like at any given moment. But
yeah, I don't think it's bad, and I think all the fire scenes, as you said, are incredibly tense and incredibly gripping and scary and worrying. And I think, to be honest, I think the way that they talk about the wider implications of this, I think that's taken from reality. I think that's why it happens the way that it does. Mm-hmm. I suspect. But yeah, I just felt like it was a very uneven film for me. So that's why I went 3 stars, which is a recommendation, just not quite
harsh. Helen O'Hara, that's what we call her.
Helen O'Hara.
Wow. Anyway.
Yes, I must admit, I did prefer this one to Steve.
I would be for Steve over this any day of the week, I've got to say. But anyway, that's pretty much running the gamut this week for the films of the week. That's exciting. And of course, many of the films we talked about last week are still in cinemas. If you haven't had a chance to go yet to things like The Long Walk, they're still there. Go see them, to go check them out, because that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we will be joined by, first of all, Chris Hewitt, who will be back, Emma Thompson, who will be joining us from The Dead of Winter. Also, we fight one more battle after one more battle after another, because Paul Thomas Anderson is also going to be joining us next week.
Excellent.
Until then.
I don't approve of public displays of PTA, so.
Wow.
Yeah.
I do.
Sorry.
I think they're great. I think we should have more of them, if anything. Until then, until that auspicious occasion, it's goodbye from Beth.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from James.
Goodbye on Pilot TV on Monday. Boy. We're having essentially a Slow Horses special. The reason I say that is because not only do we interview Christopher Chung, a.k.a. Roddy Ho, for the 5th series of Slow Horses on Apple TV+, but Ruth Bradley crashed the studio just as we were recording an hour ago, which is why we were late starting this podcast, to talk about Emma Flight, her character in it as well. And it's great, and Slow Horses is wonderful. And yes, Nick gave it 3 stars, but he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, he seemed pretty sure.
Sure that he's wrong.
Goodbye then, James. Goodbye.
Bye, Helen.
Yeah. And it's a toodaloo from me. I'm off to watch Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs to try and get this problem out of my head. Steve!